This podcast is a production of Columbia University's Center for New Media Teaching and Learning.
So today we have the pleasure of having with us Sherry Berman, Associate Professor of Political Science at Barnard College. She teaches both graduate and undergraduate courses on political development, making democracy work, and other topics. Professor Berman is an expert on and has written extensively about political development in Western Europe. My way of interpreting the subject, or how she came to the subject of her lecture today and the related articles, is that as somebody who knows an awful lot about political development and the development of democracy, she was reading and watching all the debates going on in political science about democratization, and thought it might be helpful if the people writing and talking about democratization took into consideration some of the long and not pretty history by which the West developed democracy, and I think maybe encourage them to step back a bit from their kind of insistent and time-constrained sense of development of democracies around the world today. So, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Professor Berman.
Thank you. All right. Can you hear me? No. Up closer. Can you hear me now? I feel like that Verizon commercial. No? Yes? No? No. All right. Do I have to hold it? Yeah, all right, okay, I'll do my best. This limits my ability to sort of move around, but wave your hand if you can't hear me as I move around. Okay, so having looked at your syllabus, I've sort of looked and seen all the kind of big issues in international politics that you've been talking about this term. And today what I'm going to talk to you about, as you just heard, is political development kind of broadly defined. Or more particularly, how to think about and understand how and why stable, well-functioning democracies develop. Okay? I have to move over here for this, so I hope this all works okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off with some theoretical background. Okay? I'm going to discuss with you a little bit about what I see the main division in the literature on political development as being. And that is what I term a debate between preconditionalists and universalists. Let me see if I can get this in here. How's that? Turn it up. It doesn't want to stay up. All right. How's that? Good? All right. So the debate between preconditionalists and universalists. Okay. Then I'm going to move on to an analysis of the European political development experience. And the reason for this is because I think one way to help us understand what's going on in the world today is to look back at the experience of previous political development experiences, or rather to look back at the political development experiences of countries that are currently stable, well-functioning democracies, and to actually look at the ways in which those countries developed the political systems that they have today. Surprisingly, not many political scientists have actually done this, okay? And I'm going to try to show you that the ahistorical nature of a lot of contemporary scholarship has warped our understandings of political development. And in particular, I'm going to argue that it's done this by either implicitly or sometimes explicitly comparing political development today to a somewhat idealized version of the way political development occurred in the past. Okay? And finally, the last thing I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what I think the lessons of the European experience are. Or more generally, what I think the lessons of successful political developers have for the contemporary literature on political development, as well as for countries that are going through political transitions today. Okay, so first let me turn to the literature. Oops. Literature on political development. Okay, so the most obvious, certainly what I think is the divide within both the scholarly and the policymaking community, is that which exists between what I would call preconditionalists and universalists. Okay, so preconditionalists, not surprisingly given the name, are those who believe that democracy can only exist in countries that have certain kinds of conditions or have undergone certain kinds of experiences. Okay? And this view was particularly prominent after the Second World War, when the key task for social scientists was explaining why successful democracy only seemed to exist in the West. Okay? And so preconditionalists stress deep structural factors and historical legacies and explanations of why democracy exists in some places and not others. Okay, and so what you have here are some examples of some of the big schools of preconditionalist thinking. Okay? So the first and probably the most obvious school, which I imagine most of you are familiar with, are modernization theories, right? And the basic argument here is that democracy requires a certain level of economic development to work. Wealthier countries are more likely to be democratic. Okay? Another approach within the preconditionalist category would be looking at different societal factors, and the arguments here go something like democracy requires certain societal structures or relationships, low levels of group polarization, a large middle class, relatively balanced class structure, those kinds of things. And some of the classic versions of this argument are those of Robert Dahl, Ralph Dahrendorf, Harry Eckstein. Another version of this argument, very influential, is that of Barrington Moore, which argues that democracy requires certain patterns of land ownership or a certain type of economic modernization. Another typical preconditionalist argument focuses on culture, right? So democracy requires a certain kind of culture, whether it's a Western culture or an individualist culture or a culture that separates religion from politics, any of those kinds of things. And then another pretty common preconditionalist argument stresses the path or sequence within which political development occurs. I'm going to talk about some contemporary versions of that in a few minutes, but the classic version of that was also by Robert Dahl. So the basic argument here is very straightforward, right? Where the preconditions exist, stable democracy is likely to develop. Where the preconditions don't exist, stable democracy is not. Okay? And the policy implications of this view are also pretty straightforward, right? That promoting or encouraging democratization in countries where the preconditions don't exist is likely to result in a democracy that fails, and therefore you should not be involved in that kind of endeavor. Okay, so universalists, on the other hand, believe that democracy can emerge in all kinds of places, in all kinds of ways. Okay, it doesn't require prerequisites, and again, it can exist in all different kinds of settings. Okay, within the scholarly community, universalism or universalists were in relatively short supply after the Second World War. But one particularly eloquent and influential universalist was Dankwart Rustow, who I have a quote from up here, who argued that scholars should abandon the quest for functional requisites and be skeptical of the idea that a minimum level of economic development or particular types of societal structure are necessary prerequisites for democracy. Right? But where preconditionalists dominated in the decades after the Second World War, it was the third wave that really brought universalists into the forefront of debate, right? And this is for obvious reasons. Not only did a large number of countries make transitions to democracy beginning in the early 1970s, but most of the ones that did not have the kinds of preconditions that preconditionalists would have predicted were necessary for democratization to occur. So as a result of the third wave, scholarship's emphasis shifted. It shifted from a focus on the structures or preconditions associated with successful democracy to an emphasis on sort of the agents and processes associated with transitions themselves, right? So scholars and others interested in these issues began to argue that what the third wave showed, right, in the words of one influential proponent of this view, was that, was that countries' political trajectories and the fate of their democracies in particular were influenced by short-term factors and that they could be crafted, right? That democracy was something that was influenced by things like the nature of transitions, the kinds of pacts made between key groups or key political actors, key decisions that were made in the early stages of transitions, whether leaders were smart or committed, whether they made clever choices, et cetera, et cetera. So these kinds of views, these kind of universalist views, not surprisingly contributed to a real enthusiasm for democracy promotion, right? So if you believe that democracy doesn't have necessary prerequisites, right, and that things that can be manipulated or crafted strongly influence whether or not democracy will succeed, then it means that outside actors can probably influence the process in significant ways. Okay, and of course, the third wave ushered in not only many new democracies, but many institutions and groups that were concerned with democracy promotion, that took these ideas really to heart. And so by the 1990s, governmental and non-governmental spending on things related to democracy promotion had grown to be billions of dollars annually. Okay? If we turn to the United States, the Bush administration originally came into office very skeptical of these kinds of views, of democracy promotion in particular, right? And they argued that it was a bad idea to devote too much foreign policy capital to what one administration official skeptically referred to as nation building. But 9/11 changed all that pretty rapidly as the Bush administration began to switch to what might be thought of as an extreme universalist position, right? And you had many within the administration, as well as a chorus of neoconservative commentators outside of the administration, arguing that democracy promotion was an absolutely urgent task of the United States. Okay? And these folks argued not just that democracy was a good thing and that democracy promotion was a good thing, but that the lack of democracy was dangerous, right? And that non-democratic regimes were the root cause of the terrorism and instability that plagued many parts of the world. What was interesting about this position was its incredible idealism, of course, or what some people would call naivete, right? The idea here was that the main problem in many of these countries, the main obstacles to democratization, were simply the presence of authoritarian regimes, right, or authoritarian leaders, right? And that if you got rid of the authoritarian leaders, that democracy would develop in all different parts of the world simply out of people's natural desire for freedom and self-rule. Right? And so all you needed to do in this view, right, to promote democracy was kind of get rid of the old authoritarian regime. And this was true even in places like the Middle East, where most preconditionalists would have been very skeptical about whether or not democracy would actually work. And this, of course, at least in retrospect, was part of the justification for the Iraq War, which, of course, has turned out to be a terrible failure. And the failure of the Iraq War, combined with a lot of the reversals that we've seen in many third-wave democracies, has brought a new skepticism back to the discussion of political development. Okay? And so we've seen a shift within the literature and within policy debate back to a more skeptical or preconditionalist kind of view. All right, so once again today, we hear people arguing something that would have seemed absolutely ridiculous during the initial euphoria of the third wave, namely that successful democracies will only emerge in countries where certain kinds of preconditions exist or certain kinds of historical patterns have been followed. Okay, and this is where your readings for this week come in. All right, some of the most interesting members of this group were on your reading list for this week. Right, Jack Snyder and Ed Mansfield, and Fareed Zakaria. So in the article that you read by Zakaria on called A Liberal Democracy, but even more in the book that followed from this article called The Future of Freedom, Zakaria argues that transitioning to democracy in countries that have no history of liberalism, and by liberalism he essentially means the rule of law and a state willing and able to enforce the rule of law, will run quickly into trouble, that those kinds of democracies will not work very well at all. Okay? And similarly, Jack Snyder and Ed Mansfield in Electing to Fight, which I think you read sections from in week 5 of this class, but also the argument is repeated in some of the readings for this week, stress the dangers that can arise when democratic transitions do not follow an auspicious sequence, one in which the strong political institutions that make democracy work, effective state, the rule of law, etc., develop before democratization occurs. All right, so like their predecessors, therefore, this new crop of preconditionalists is wary, if not outright hostile, towards democracy promotion, since they believe that encouraging transitions in such countries, countries that lack these requisite features or experiences or conditions that they stress, will not lead to stable democracy, but will likely lead to instability or illiberalism. Okay? So again, as Mansfield and Snyder put it, ill-prepared attempts to democratize countries where the institutional requisites for successful consolidation are not yet in place may lead to costly warfare in the short run and may delay or prevent real progress towards democracy over the long term. Okay? It's also important to note that many of the folks in this camp, this preconditionalist camp, worry about premature democratization not only because they think it's likely to fail, but also because they have a view of political development that's path dependent. Okay? And by path dependent, all path dependent means is that if a country makes a sort of premature transition to democracy, that is to say, one before the conditions are absolutely ready, or if a country fails in its attempt to install a democratic regime, then that country's likely to sort of get stuck on a suboptimal path, right? Slowing down political development overall. Okay? And again, so here's Mansfield and Snyder on path dependence in the some of the pieces that you read. Okay? Once a country starts on a liberal trajectory, ideas are unleashed and institutions are established that tend to continue propelling that country along the trajectory. Okay? Premature, out-of-sequence attempts to democratize may make subsequent efforts to democratize more difficult and more violent than they would otherwise be. All right, so given the importance of understanding how and why stable democracies actually develop, the kind of cyclical nature of these debates can be a little bit depressing, right? So what I want to argue today, what I'd like to try to convince you, is that one way to gain some perspective on these debates and on questions about how to understand political development overall is to take a look back at history. Right? To examine the actual ways in which democracy developed in countries that currently have stable, well-functioning democratic regimes. Okay? Now, I want to be clear what I'm not saying here. What I'm not saying here is that political development always happens in exactly the same way. Okay? Because obviously it doesn't, right? But what I am going to sort of base these arguments on is a belief that I think pervades the social sciences, namely that there are patterns in history, right? That there are certain variables and processes that reoccur across time, and that if we're careful, we can make generalizations based on them, right? So as Mark Twain sort of famously put it, history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And that's the basis upon which I'm going to talk about history today. Right? So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give you a little history primer. I'm going to give you a little brief analysis of the way in which democracy actually developed in the part of the world that's home to a majority of today's stable, well-functioning democracies, namely Western Europe. But I'm going to do this, right, not to teach you about Western European political history, as scintillating as that is, but in order to try to convince you that this history has something to teach us about political development today. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to make explicit what I think the lessons and the relevance of the West European experience are to contemporary democratizers today. And, I mean, we can talk more about this, obviously, in the Q&A. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give you a little quick history lesson. So bear with me. I assume a lot of this will be familiar to you, but it has a point. Okay, so here we go. So most people start talking about democracy in Europe, right? Believe that democracies really began with the French Revolution, which was from 1789 to 1799. Okay. Now, one thing to notice about this starting date, right, is that it's obviously not the ending date of the process of political development in Europe, right? The French Revolution was in many ways a disaster. Okay. Not only did it not, of course, end in stable democracy, but it threw France and much of the rest of Europe into political turmoil for many years to come. It also taught the French and other Europeans a lesson that they would learn over and over again over the following centuries. Namely, right, an important lesson, that getting rid of the old regime was a lot easier than building up a new one, especially if that new one was a democracy. Okay? But the French Revolution wasn't only a disaster, of course. As we'll see, it wasn't only Europe's first attempt at democracy, even if it failed. But its legacies helped ensure that there was no going back to the status quo ante. Okay? All subsequent attempts at democratization in Europe would have something to build on. Okay? So let me briefly take you through how this revolution unfolded. right? So it begins in 1789, as I'm sure you're all aware, with a bunch of dramatic events, the calling of the Estates General and a National Assembly, the storming of the Bastille, and the removal of the king from Versailles to Paris. The first attempt to create a new political order in the aftermath of this revolution was in 1791, when a constitutional monarchy was proposed. Okay? And this was in some ways a kind of logical transition from the absolutism that had existed before, right? This kind of regime would have given France basically a sort of constitutional and somewhat more representative political order. The king's power would have been circumscribed, and he would have been forced to live with a limited suffrage. But not surprisingly, this type of moderate reform didn't make anybody in France very happy. Okay? The conservatives didn't like the fact that it was a reform at all, and the radicals didn't like the fact that the reform stopped short of true democratization. So as a result, conflict continues, and by 1793, the radicals emerge triumphant. Okay? And then the king, who was Louis XVI, found himself like another modern-day monarch who we are probably all familiar with his head cut off. Now, at this time, there were no cell phones to record the event, but as you can see, we all know what happened anyway. And so the king was now very much gone, okay? And a republic was declared with universal suffrage, civil and political liberties, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the origin of France's first real democracy and Europe's first modern democracy, okay? However, despite the incredible excitement and the sense of triumph that accompanied these events, this democratic experiment soon faltered. Okay? This new regime believed itself to be encircled by enemies both within and without. Okay? And it soon embarked as a result on a pretty widespread campaign of both internal repression and then subsequently external war. So between 1793 and 1794, France had to endure the Reign of Terror, during which historians estimate that between 20 and 40,000 people lost their lives, had their heads chopped off for counter-revolutionary activities. Okay, and France also, at the same time, again, had to fight other countries who were determined to kind of push back this democratic wave. As you might imagine, most French men and women didn't really count on this kind of turmoil when they supported the revolution. They didn't hope for this kind of conflict when the old regime collapsed. And so by 1799, exhausted from its internal and external battles, France submitted to a strongman, right, who promised to return order, Napoleon Bonaparte, right, the man on horseback, as the famous picture makes clear. So in the space of a decade, what do we have in France, right? In the space of about 10 years, France had gone from a hereditary dictatorship, the monarchy, right, to war and domestic chaos, and then back to dictatorship, but this is a dictatorship of a very new variety, right? It was a military dictatorship. So as we can see, France and Europe's first experiment with democracy didn't last very long, but its legacies, both positive and negative, were really quite profound. Okay, so on the negative side of the ledger, in addition to being a failure, obviously the revolution failed in the sense of not bringing a stable democracy into being, it also left France very, very divided. Okay, and in the divisions that emerged as a result of the revolution would continue to plague France and would leave France in a state of political instability and social conflict for many years to come. On the positive side, however, absolutism, right, was gone forever. Okay? Although France was unable to sustain democracy at this time, there was no going back to the status quo ante. Okay? Not only did the reforms that were undertaken during the revolution undercut the socioeconomic support of the ancien regime, but just as importantly, the attitudes and expectations that were formed during the revolution meant that there was no going back to a completely unrepresentative political order. Many people had their first real taste of political participation during these years, and as a result of this and the demolition of the traditional support of conservatives, even the monarchs and dictators that ruled subsequent to the revolution had to rule in a very different way. Okay? They had to do something. They had to respond in some ways to the demands of their citizens in ways that they never had to before. Okay, so even after Napoleon, the man on horseback, falls from power and a new king comes back to France in 1814, this new king rules under a constitutional regime. Okay, this regime has a two-chamber parliament that has limited suffrage and that guarantees important civil and political liberties. However, largely as a result of the instability that followed France after the revolution and the divisions that I mentioned briefly, this new king finds himself ruling over an incredibly restive and politically frustrated society, right? And as most or as many authoritarians do in response to those kinds of conditions, he resorts to repression to try to restore order. And when this king, Charles X, combines this repression with a turn to religious conservatives to bolster his regime, right? France once again kind of explodes in political turmoil in 1830, and this king, Charles X, is sent sort of scurrying off into political exile. So when the dust is settled from this, France makes yet another transition, this time to what we would probably think of today as a sort of liberal authoritarian political regime, right? There's still a king in this new regime after 1830, but the suffrage was greatly expanded. And the clergy and the aristocracy, the kind of main bulwarks of the conservative regime, their power is greatly diminished. Okay? But the liberalness of this new regime kind of pisses off conservatives a lot, while the authoritarian part of the regime really pisses off sort of Democrats. And so once again, pretty quickly, you have France kind of descending back into this period, this kind of typical pattern of political chaos and domestic strife. This brings us to the next critical junction. As you may notice as these pictures go on, none of these pictures are particularly sort of peaceful, right? They're always kind of filled with these scenes of kind of bloody conflict, right? So by 1848, the country, France, had once again kind of reached a boiling point and moves again towards yet another political transition. And this time, like in 1789, this political transition takes the rest of Europe with it, right? So after 1789, in fact, 1848 is the next critical juncture in Europe's political development experience, right? And there are several striking things about the wave of democracy that happens in 1848 in Europe, okay? The first thing that's important to notice about 1848 is how extensive this wave is and how rapidly authoritarian regimes fall in 1848. The second thing is how quickly and completely not only these authoritarian regimes collapse, but how soon after these authoritarian regimes collapse, divisions begin to occur within the political opposition that had helped to overthrow those authoritarian regimes, right? So the authoritarian regimes fall quickly, but pretty quickly thereafter, the political opposition begins to squabble amongst itself, and it becomes very difficult to maintain political gains once that squabbling begins. Okay, so as in 1789, in 1848, Europe takes a big step towards democracy, right? But then it takes a big step back, right? And A.J.P. Taylor, who's a great historian of Europe, in a sort of typically witty comment, says that in 1848, Europe reached its turning point, but it failed to turn. Okay, so what happens in 1848 in Europe, right? So again, as in 1789, the collapse of the French regime sort of sends shockwaves across the continent. So as you can see, sort of from all over the continent, from north to south, from east to west, there's outbreaks of revolution, or rather outbreaks of demands for political change. And at first, as I noticed, these protests seem really very effective. So absolutist dictatorial regimes begin to totter all across the continent, even in places where absolutism had seemed to be sort of strongest, right, where the regime seemed to be most powerful, right? So some of those places, in Austria, for example, the emperor is forced to dump his long-standing sort of political leader, Metternich, right, who had not only run the empire for decades, but for any of you who know anything about European history, know Metternich had been the sort of architect of some of the sort of institutions and relationships and arrangements that had tried to restore the Ancien Regime in Europe after 1789. Right, but almost as soon as this old order begins to totter, right, fissures, as I mentioned, fissures begin to open up in the opposition groups, okay? So in country after country, even though it was clear that there was massive discontent with the old order, with the absolutist dictatorial regimes. There's also massive disagreements within the opposition about what should follow the collapse of the authoritarian or dictatorial regimes, right? And there's two types of disagreements that prove to be particularly problematic in 1848, okay? The first disagreements are those between liberals and Democrats, right? Liberals being people who wanted to reform the old regime, but who were very worried about going all the way towards democracy, and Democrats being those who wanted a complete change of political regime, who wanted full democratization, universal suffrage, the whole thing. To some degree, this is a class division in 1848, with liberals being more middle class and Democrats being more working class, but that's sort of a little bit inexact. The second type of division that proves to be very difficult to deal with in 1848 is that about nationality. Okay? So then as now, we see the same pressures that are pushing political reform to the forefront of the agenda in Europe are also bringing to the forefront questions about state building and national identity. Okay, so just as the old order begins to weaken across Europe in 1848, right? Not only did we see frustration with the old regime, the old political order exploding, but we also begin to see suppressed national, ethnic, and religious conflicts coming to the fore, right? And across Europe, the combination of these things makes it very difficult to hold on to political gains, right? So in the Habsburg Empire, the Austrian Empire as it's kind of listed here, the minute the old regime begins to totter, all of the different groups in the Habsburg Empire begin to press for all kinds of changes, right? So the Hungarians, the Poles, the Romanians, the Czechs, the Croats, all of these groups had long-standing grievances against the empire, and in particular against the German-speaking elite that had run it, right? And so they begin to demand more autonomy and self-rule. Right? The Hungarians, for example, proclaim their own government, right? And they make Hungarian a requirement for political office. And as you might imagine, not that many people who were not Hungarian spoke Hungarian. And so this really upsets people within Hungarian territories who do not speak Hungarian, right? Because they understood that this reform would essentially disenfranchise them. And so these folks then began to see the Habsburgs, right, their multinational kind of approach, as their best protectors, right? At the same time, all the different Slavic minorities within the Habsburg Empire also try to force through changes that would increase their capacity for self-rule. But these changes were opposed by minorities within those territories, as well as by the ruling German elite, who felt that any changes that would give the Slavs more power would, by definition, disenfranchise them. And so German-speaking elites within these territories and in the capital, Vienna, begin to push back against the Slavic minorities who are trying to gain greater self-rule. And so what you began to see happening was that people who agreed on the need for political change began to divide up about questions of political autonomy and self-rule, and about what kinds of changes and of what kind, what variety of changes should accompany the collapse of the old regime, right? Another place where these kinds of issues really prove to be important is Germany, right? In 1848, you get delegates from all of the German-speaking lands meeting in Frankfurt to devise a new constitution for Germany. But here, again, you see problems emerging very rapidly. The delegates are able to agree on what they call a declaration of fundamental rights that calls for things like freedom of speech, improved suffrage, equality before the law, et cetera, but they couldn't agree on a whole bunch of other issues, particularly issues, again, that have to do with nationality questions. So they can't agree not only on whether the new Germany should be a republic or a constitutional monarchy, but they can't agree on whether or not the new Germany should include all Germans or should exclude some Germans for practical reasons, Germans who lived in parts of Europe where it would be very difficult practically to integrate them into a new political order. Also, they couldn't agree on whether or not non-Germans living within the borders of this new Germany should be given the same rights and privileges as German citizens, or whether they should be given a sort of second-class status. And so the delegates to the Frankfurt Parliament began to bicker over these issues, and the more they bickered, the more people became frustrated, and the more conservatives became re-emboldened. And so when this parliament finally decided to offer the crown of this new Germany to the Prussian Frederick William IV, he decides to turn it down. Okay, he tells the delegates to go home. He doesn't want this dirty crown. And protests break out, but he's very easily able to put them down. Okay, so if we turn then from Germany back to France, the picture doesn't get all that much prettier. The transition in France isn't marred by nationality issues as it is in other parts of the continent. But here, again, you have long-standing political divisions that make transitions to democracy very difficult, right? Here in France, the main division centers on, again, the degree and the type of reforms that should accompany a new regime, right? Working and poor people go to the streets to demand not only political change, but important economic changes. But the new National Assembly, which is very concerned not to repeat the same kind of mistakes that happened in 1789, very concerned in particular to maintain political order, decides that it's very important to squash these kinds of protests, and it sends out the National Guard to deal with these kind of striking workers and people out on the street. And when the dust settles, about 4,500 other people have been killed, and 12,000 people are arrested. This does succeed in keeping the protesters quiet, but the price that the new regime pays for this is very high. Not only are a lot of people alienated from the new regime, but a lot of people become frightened that France is once again on the verge of chaos. And so when presidential elections are held in France in December of 1848, they're once again won by someone who promises France a return to stability, right? This is Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, right? Napoleon III. Right, who again comes back and promises France that he can put things back in its place. Right now, he's elected by universal suffrage. This Napoleon Bonaparte is, but he's a new type of political leader. Right, he's a type of political leader that we're going to see that is very familiar to us today. Right, he's essentially a kind of military authoritarian populist. Right, almost as soon as he gets into office, this Napoleon Bonaparte begins working to undermine the foundations of the Republic. Right, when he asks the National Assembly to amend the Constitution so that he can run for office again past his allotted term in office, they turn him down, and so he decides he's just going to arrest them. Right, so he turns around and he arrests those people in the Assembly who oppose him in 1851. He then holds a plebiscite to kind of get public support, popular support for his rule, and he installs a new constitution that kind of sets him up in office for life. So he's kind of a sort of modern-day Chavez or Musharraf, right? So by 1851, there's not a lot left of this democratic wave that had swept Europe in 1848, right? But even though you don't get stable democracy in Europe again in 1848, again, it's important to think about what the legacies of this democratic wave were. Okay. On the positive side, 1848 brings Europe once again a step further away from absolutism. So just as I said in 1789, after 1789 in France, conservatives realized that there was no going back to the old order. You have a similar type of dynamic after 1848 in Europe more generally, right? Even those old absolutist regimes that come back into power after 1848 fails take a very new, a very different form. Right? They realize that they have to modernize somewhat to be able to keep their populations happy. And conservatives recognize that if they want to win this battle with the rising forces of progress and democracy, that they're going to have to organize themselves in new ways, that they're going to have to reach out to people, they're going to have to form new political organizations and new kinds of alliances. And as for people themselves, after 1848, even though, again, a lot of the forms of political participation and organization fade away, some of them manage to stay in place, although they evolve over time. And so a lot of the new political parties and civil society organizations that form in 1848 continue to play a role in Europe after the democratic wave subsides. And most importantly, right, the unfinished business of 1848, right, both politically and nationally, does not disappear as the democratic wave subsides, right? And it's precisely the issues that are raised during 1848 that continue to define European politics up through the 20th century, right? So in Italy and Germany, for example, questions about nationalism and nationality are the key things that define politics during the late 19th and early 20th century. In Germany, unification occurs during the late 19th century, not as a result of kind of peaceful negotiations in the Frankfurt Parliament, but through war and under the tutelage of a sort of conservative autocrat, Otto von Bismarck, with his nice hat there. And you finally get a unified Germany in 1871 under what we would now think of as a kind of soft or maybe a liberal authoritarian regime. Right? We have a king or a Kaiser, but we also have a two-chambered parliament, one chamber being somewhat more conservative and the other more democratic. And this new political order runs into trouble pretty quickly, right? Again, with the sort of the democratic and the authoritarian elements in tension with each other, right? The conservatives don't like the democratic aspects and the Democrats don't like the conservative ones. And as time passes and Germany becomes wealthier and more developed, these tensions begin to become more and more difficult to deal with. Conservatives really resist any kind of political change, and as a result, what you get in Germany during the late 19th and early 20th century is rising political conflict, increased political frustration, and also the growth of extremist groups very much opposed to the existing political order. Some scholars, in particular for those of you who know German history well, a person named Fritz Fischer, argue that it's precisely this kind of political stalemate that causes Germany to rush headlong into the First World War. You have a not dissimilar dynamic in Italy, right? Here you have unification completed essentially in the 1860s, right? And you also have a kind of mixed political order. But this new order also proves to be unable to deal with the country's political problems, in particular divisions between North and South. And you get a regime that runs into increasing political stalemate, growing political corruption, rising political frustration. And again, you see late 19th and early 20th century Italy plagued by the rise of extremist and anti-democratic groups. And this pattern, in fact, repeats itself across Europe throughout the late 19th and early 20th centuries, right? So you have a dizzying array of political changes that occur throughout Europe of this time. Spain, Austria, all of these countries go through an endless cycle of kind of trying new types of political institutions during this period. France, of course, is always at the forefront of these changes, right? You have another transition to democracy in France in 1871, right? Another revolutionary uprising. This one is the Paris Commune, right? And here you have about 20,000 people losing their lives in this transition. You have a third republic that's declared in France in 1875, although we wouldn't, in today's terms, probably consider this regime to have been a fully consolidated one. It's constantly threatened throughout its time in existence by numerous challenges, perhaps the most famous of which is the Dreyfus Affair, where you see military threats to civilian rule and the incredible divisions that continue to hinder political stability in France, right? So on the eve of the First World War, what you get is a continent that had behind it several decades of rising political instability, mobilization, and conflict, right? The First World War brings a lot of the regimes in Europe crashing down and a transition to new democratic regimes in much of the continent, right? But these new democratic regimes that come into being in 1918 are burdened by an incredible number of problems and challenges, right? You have the economic devastation of the war, the inflation that follows, the Great Depression that comes in the early 30s, the incredible political divisions that built up in the lead up to the war and then are intensified as the result of the war. You have opposition movements on left and right that oppose democracy. And particularly for the countries that lost the war, you have this incredible sense of national humiliation, right, that democracy was associated with, right? And so given these problems, it's not surprising that many of the democratic regimes that came into being in Europe after 1918 failed pretty quickly. Italy collapses into fascism in 1922, Germany into National Socialism in 1933, and Spain and Austria into civil war and dictatorship also in the early 1930s. So in addition to being a period of immense political turmoil, the first third of the 20th century was also a period of unbelievable ethnic conflict in Europe, right? On the periphery of Europe, There's the Balkan Wars of 1912 to 1913, where about 500,000 people were forced to leave their homes. In Turkey, after the First World War, of course, not only were untold numbers of Armenians killed, but you have 1.5 million Greeks that are expelled from Turkey and about 400,000 Turks that are expelled from Greece. After the war, the collapse of the Habsburg Empire and the formation of a whole range of new states in Central and Eastern Europe with very, very mixed populations brings immense amounts of ethnic conflicts, right? So in the new state of Poland, which is formed after the First World War, about 1/3 of the people living within the borders of this new Polish state are not ethnically Polish. They're Jews, Germans, Ukrainians. Czechoslovakia had 3 million Germans living inside its borders. Romania had 1.5 million Hungarians. And in fact, of the new states that were created by the First World War, 25 million out of the 60 million people living in these states were not members of the dominant ethnic group, right? So the borders of the states formed after the First World War were completely kind of screwed up from an ethnic perspective, right? So this concept of kind of borders that do not correspond to political power, ethnicity, is very much something that's true, not just of contemporary states today, but very much true of Europe up through the middle half of the 20th century. Right, so throughout this period, Europe is plagued by ethnic conflict. Of course, this conflict explodes during the Second World War. And it's in fact only after the Second World War that Europe's finally able to kind of put an end to these political problems and these problems of ethnic conflict that had plagued it for many decades. So in retrospect, what we can see, right, is that in 1945, the conditions for democratic consolidation in Europe were almost perfect, right? So the first thing that happens in 1945 that's important is that the old regime is completely discredited, right? It had just lost a war and it brought its societies untold violence and chaos, right? And also the socioeconomic support for the old regime is destroyed by the conflict itself. Second important thing that happens after 1945 is the continent's most conflict-ridden and problematic country, Germany, right, is occupied over the has a relatively long-term occupation, right, and this occupation plays an important role in fixing Germany on a democratic path. Also important is that the world's strongest democracy, the United States, makes a strong commitment to ensuring that democracy is consolidated in Western Europe, right? It makes a political and an economic commitment to achieving this goal. It also helps to form a whole range of multilateral institutions that are supposed to tie Western Europe not only to the United States, but tie West Europeans to each other. And also important is that ethnic cleansing on a huge scale happens after and during the war, right? And this gives West European countries, for the first time in the modern era, somewhat homogeneous populations and borders that more or less correspond to particular ethnic groups, right? So from autumn of 1944 to the middle of 1945, 5 million Germans are forced to flee to the west from different parts of Eastern Europe. From 1945 to 1947, that is to say just after the war, the new regimes in Czechoslovakia, Poland, and Hungary expel another 7 million Germans from their territory. 1.5 million Poles are forced to flee to Poland from areas that were part of the Soviet Union. 500,000 Ukrainians are sent from Poland to Ukraine. The Slovaks are sent from Hungary to Czechoslovakia, blah, blah, the list goes on, right? Huge, huge, unbelievable population transfers that occur during and after the Second World War. So in addition to the ethnic cleansing that we all know about that happened during the war, right, particularly when almost the continent's entire Jewish population is eliminated, millions were moved and perhaps hundreds of thousands were killed, right, after the war as the states that formed after the war took advantage of the war's chaos to expel from its borders populations that they felt were problematic or dangerous in some ways, right? And so the result was that after 1945, nations and states corresponded in Europe again in a way they had not throughout most of the modern era. And another final important factor to take into account when trying to explain why democracy succeeds in Europe after 1945, but not before, was that the new democratic regimes that are reconstructed after 1945 don't have to start from scratch, right? Even in places like Germany and Italy, where the dictatorships had been homegrown and relatively long-lasting, everything from political parties to civil society organizations to media groups, all of these things could be resurrected, right? They didn't have to start from scratch, right? They could be reclaimed from the ashes of the war and the dictatorships, right? So democracy didn't really have to be started anew. It had to be kind of rebuilt after 1945, right? And so with all of these factors in place, the struggle for democracy that had begun in 1789 in Europe finally comes to a close after 1945. All right, so there's the sort of historical run-through. So what are the lessons, right? What are the things that I think this history of Europe is supposed to teach us if we're interested in questions of political development today? Well, first, I think that it shows us that at the very least, the kind of straightforward versions of the preconditionalist and the universalist arguments have problems. Okay? The universalists, I think, are certainly right to stress that democracy can emerge in any number of ways and in any number of settings. That certainly seems to have been the case historically. All kinds of European countries with all different kinds of backgrounds made transitions to democracy during the 19th and the 20th century. But what we also saw was that most of these transitions failed, and they often failed in very chaotic and very violent ways. Okay? So the preconditionalists are probably right to be skeptical about the chances for successful democratization or consolidation. But they're wrong, I think, to think that well-functioning democracies only emerge in countries that are characterized by very particular conditions or backstories. Indeed, I think if there's one thing that the European cases show us, it's that history provides us with very few, if any, examples of countries that emerged with stable democracies in the manner predicted by or favored by preconditionalists. In particular, none of the stable, well-functioning democracies that exist in Europe today emerged in some sort of easy, gradual, stage-like manner. Pretty much all the democracies that exist in Europe today had incredibly turbulent, incredibly conflictual, and incredibly bloody backstories. Right? So France had to endure an incredibly bloody and divisive revolution in 1789, and then it suffered through a century and a half of political instability before finally settling down to a stable democratic order with the Fifth Republic in 1958. Germany is unified finally in 1871 as a result of three wars. But then, again, trying to stave off political change helps to contribute to the First World War. Then we have a collapsed democratic experiment in the interwar years, perhaps the most terrible dictatorship the world had ever known. And then democracy only comes to Germany after the loss of a war and a long-term occupation, right? And then, of course, only to the western half of Germany. Similar winding and difficult paths characterize almost all European countries. Same story for Italy, for Austria, for Spain. All of these countries had to go through a great number of transitions and a large number of conflicts before they were finally able to sustain well-functioning democracies in the 20th century. Even the country that's held up most often as the kind of paradigmatic example of a successful democracy that emerged in a gradual liberalism first manner, England, right? England's the kind of, this is the way we'd all like to develop. Even here, right, England had to suffer through in the 17th century a great period, a long period of civil war and domestic chaos before the country was firmly put on a path to parliamentary government, right? So even here, the backstory to democracy, although it starts much earlier, is one that has a long period of conflict and violence. And there in England, it takes over two centuries before a full transition to democracy occurs, right? And the United States, right? The United States is in many ways an exception because unlike almost every other country, it starts its political life without an ancien regime or a feudal past that it needs to get rid of, right? But even here, right, it takes the Civil War, the bloodiest war in our history, to get rid of the anti-democratic institutions and norms that were built into our democracy from the beginning, right? So even here, it takes an incredible period of bloody conflict for us to be put on a path where, again, the anti-democratic parts of our political system are gotten rid of, and then it takes another century at least for our national government to be able to bring real political rights and liberties to a significant sector of our population. And if we turn to the non-European cases of successful democratization that occurred in the late 20th century, right? Chile, South Korea, Brazil, these are the kinds of places that are held up as examples of successful third wave democracies. Here too, we see that all of these countries had very difficult backstories, right? All of these countries have backstories that include failed democratic experiments, civil wars, occupations, and much else. So one important lesson I think history seems to teach us, right? And this is a lesson that I think conflicts with arguments made by many preconditionalists, is that democratic backsliding or failures absolutely does not preclude later democratic success. Okay? To put this in the terms of some of the literature I talked about earlier, I don't think history supports, for example, the assertion made by Mansfield and Snyder in your readings today that premature transitions inevitably make things worse, okay? Inevitably make things worse over the long term, right? I don't think history seems to show that this kind of path dependence exists, right? Even disasters like the French Revolution and the collapse of the Weimar Republic, none of these things ruled out later democratic development. In fact, I think it is often the case, right, that many of the failures and problems that we see in political developmental paths, right, are necessary parts of the long-term process by which the institutions, structures, relationships, cultures of the old regime are eradicated and new ones are built up, right? That you have to learn from mistakes. You can't learn from mistakes if you're not allowed to make them, right? And I think many contemporary analysts don't realize this because they either ignore or downplay how difficult the political development trajectories of successful democracies actually were. Okay, so I think the idea that this sort of gradual liberalism first path to democracy exists and that we should discourage countries that are not kind of in that place for making a transition to democracy, I don't think there's a lot of historical support for this argument. Okay, I think making this claim also holds contemporary democratizers to a standard that many countries would not have been held, could not have met in the past, right? And it doesn't correspond to the actual ways in which current stable, well-functioning democracies actually developed. I also think it assumes that authoritarian regimes are better at creating these preconditions than democratic ones are. And again, I don't think there's much historical evidence that authoritarian regimes were better able to put countries on the democratic path than failed democratic ones were. Another way of putting this point, right, is that another way of putting the point that this easy path or this liberalism first path to democracy doesn't exist is to say that violence and conflict, and especially violence and conflict of a communal nature, is integral to the process of political development. Now, one reason for this I already mentioned. It's because I think the emergence of stable democracies requires getting rid of the institutions and the structures and the relationships and the norms of the old regime, and this never happens easily. Okay, old regimes never go easily, and it takes a long time to eradicate their roots in societies and political orders. But another reason why I think this is the case, right, that political development is almost inherently violent and conflictual, is that many of the factors, many of the historical processes that push forward democratization are the same factors that push forward nation-state formation. These two processes are inextricably intertwined, right? And as we saw in Europe, as is the case in many parts of the world today, questions about the nature of the political order and questions about the nature of national identity are very much go together, right? And this is a very explosive, very difficult mix, right? So as I pointed out, stable democracy only emerges in Europe after a long period of ethnic cleansing and conflict. And in a setting that was, after 1945, again, when stable democracy emerges, relatively historically homogenous, especially compared to what existed in Europe before. All right, so to sort of wrap up, okay, I think history also teaches us that a longer-term, more historically sensitive, more historically informed perspective on political development is necessary, right? If we think about what's going on today, in comparison to patterns of political development that held in the past, we shouldn't be surprised, for example, that so many young democracies today, so many transitions are frankly sort of a mess, right? We saw that in the European cases, it was much easier to overthrow an old regime, an old authoritarian order, than to build a new stable democratic one. And there are contemporary examples of this dynamic everywhere today, in the news, Georgia, Pakistan, all over the place. We also saw that most countries' first experiments with democracy were failures, right? If it took France, right, the home of modern democracy, 150 years to get democracy right, it's not surprising that it's taking a lot of countries today more than a generation to build stable liberal democratic orders. And it seems to me that if we take this kind of longer term, more historically informed perspective, right, that the policy implications of this are also really quite profound, right? It means changing your expectations about what policy can actually achieve, right? It means changing your expectations about what kind of progress you can or should expect newly transitioning societies to make over the short to medium term. Just as we now sort of recognize economic development to be a long-term and ongoing process, I think we should also view political development as something that takes a very, very long time. And that almost inevitably entails a lot of experimentation, problems, and backsliding. But this doesn't mean, I think, that we should give up, right, on countries that are making these early transitions, right? It doesn't mean that outside actors have no role, positive role to play. It just means, I think, that we need to be very realistic about what we can expect both from new democracies and from those organizations, institutions, and people that want to help them along. Thank you.
This podcast is a production of Columbia University's Center for New Media Teaching and Learning.